Excellent. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I really want to thank Martin Ford and Robin Chase for joining us this afternoon here in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building for the first of a series of conversations that we're hoping to have that we're calling White House conversations. This goes back to something the President laid out in the State of the Union at the start of the year and has been talking about in Springfield, Elkhart, and elsewhere, where he hopes we can have the kinds of informed debates and discussions around issues of intense interest to the country directly with the American people. We've got two noted experts on a particular topic today, namely automation and its impact on the United States, on our economy. And the goal here is to just make sure that we're touching directly through various social networks people who have an interest in, concern about a particular topic. So today we're going to talk about automation. The reason we start with this, I think, is obvious. It's a particular, an issue of particular interest, and it's an issue that touches a lot of different questions as it relates to public policy. In my chair in this building, this is emblematic of an issue, a difficult issue that we try to address to make sure that we are appropriately employing public policy tools to limit the costs and increasing the benefits of new issues and policies like this. And I want to just try to address this the way we do when we get a tough policy issue like this, which is to first try to set the basis of our shared understanding or shared objective in approaching a particular issue. In National Security Council, we do it by having a briefing from the intelligence people right at the top of a meeting to make sure we're talking about the same thing. So let me try to do the same thing here and just talk to two noted experts on what is it that we mean when we talk about automation now in the United States. We've had a variety of, everything you read on this suggests that over the course of history, we've had a variety of moments of technological change. And so what makes this moment unique, and what is it that we mean when we start talking about automation and its impact on the U.S. economy? And why don't I start with you, Roman?
I was thinking we're going to start with Martin. When I think about automation, you're right, that's been happening for a long time. I think it's the pace that is really so distinct right now. So we have big data and deep learning and incredible skills. So the pace of our ability to automate is what's just accelerated. So if I think about the one that's dearest to my heart, the impending autonomous vehicles, it probably took 50 years to go from horse and buggies to the infrastructure that we know today, and that added huge jobs. It added, we had to build the infrastructure, have the manufacturing, have clever engineers. It was a huge, giant, big buildup of jobs. Whereas the transition that we're doing today from cars we have today to autonomous cars, it's going to happen within, it'll start happening in 5 years, and I think the transition will be incredibly fast. We're not going to need a big new infrastructure build out. We're going to lose all those jobs of drivers. We're going to use people, we'll be using it differently. So it's this huge collapse of one kind of labor. And I know we always want to say, yeah, you open up another window. And I look, and it's the pace of change that is so significantly different that I think this will play out in 5 to 10 years, not 50.
So it seems like it seems like the country's feeling the pace of change. And if you just think about cars, automation I used to think was a reflection of what's happening to make the cars. I think what you're suggesting is now automation is now maybe technology is taking over the driving of cars. But we'll come back to a couple of those questions. Martin, what about you? What does automation mean to you? And why is it an issue that we have such angst about, and why is it an issue that policymakers should be digging in on?
Right. Well, the key question is this time different? Because this is an issue that's been around for, at a minimum, 200 years, and it's come up again and again. But I really do think that there are good reasons to believe that maybe this time is going to be different. And if there's one thing that you would focus on, it's the fact that the machines are beginning to learn. You know, there's still this very conventional view out there that computers do what they're programmed to do. Either someone sits down and programs them step by step. And of course, that's the approach that has been used historically in automating factories and so forth. But now we have algorithms that can actually churn through data, and based on that, they can learn. So you know, it's going far beyond step-by-step programming. It's this holistic ability of the technology to actually learn new things and to make predictions. And I think that where that leads to in the longer run is where really almost any kind of work that's on some level routine and predictable is going to be very highly susceptible to this. And that's a very large fraction of our workforce and a very large fraction of the kinds of jobs that most average people do. So it could be very disruptive.
It's interesting. So it's either the pace or the depth or both of automation now. And this concept of deep learning I want to come back to for a second, but I want to ask you guys maybe a counterintuitive question because you come at this a little bit differently, as I think your initial answer suggests. And I'll start with you this time, Martin, to say, I think everything you just said stands to reason, and I've been reading your stuff all weekend. It's fascinating. But tell me one thing about automation or artificial intelligence that excites you and that makes you more optimistic about opportunity.
Well, I think there are a range of things. I mean, we can imagine in the field of medicine that artificial intelligence will make medical diagnosis much more effective. It will make treatment plans much more effective and consistent. It will help to drive down costs in the field of medicine and healthcare, which is, you know, really one of the biggest challenges we face as a society and an economy. And those benefits will scale across our whole economy. So there are, you know, fantastic things to be very excited about, but what we have to do is understand that there's also a disruptive side, and I think that what we're going to have to do in the future is figure out how to adapt to this so we can get all that good stuff while mitigating the problems.
Fair. You sound like a good White House staffer there. Mitigating problems while creating opportunities. I like that. If we're going to be sticking around for a while, we might want to try to lure you in here. But Robin, what about you? You've made a career of seeing around technological corners and seeing opportunities. But what about automation at this moment alarms you or gives you pause?
I've been thinking about how we shape economies, and for the last 100 years, we have been chasing productivity. We've been saying, wow, productivity is so great, it's going to lift all boats. It's how we have done what we've done over the last 50 years to make everyone have a better life. And suddenly, these productivity improvements come without labor. And so it's not clear at all that these productivity gains will result in everyday person having a better life, in that if they don't have a job, they don't have a better life. So again, to transportation, yes, I'll be able to not die in a car accident. I won't have all those injuries, be able to have cheap transport, and a large number of people will be unemployed. So it's this incredible balance. So we were discussing this before. Most of the automation, which is hard to build that thing, I can imagine the R&D is enormous.
Yeah.
And there'll always be some ongoing improvements, but the marginal cost of each and every transaction will be very low. And so people will get incredibly rich off of these platforms while we eliminate jobs. So I look at it and I think, how are we going to distribute those gains? How are we going to give people a lot of other fantastic things that we can talk about?
Well, I think that's a good place to jump in here then, as if the question is technology not only begins, I think as you hinted, Martin, but maybe you can give us a little bit better sense of this, begins to put some employment, some jobs at risk of being replaced, humans being replaced by this more robust capability in technology. And not only that, but as Robin has just said, technology has traditionally, as we've seen over the last several decades, dramatically returned on capital investment, so thereby making those more wealthy even more wealthy as a result of their abilities to turn investments in technology. How should we be thinking about that last question that Robin posed, namely, how do we channel this in a way that maximizes opportunity while minimizing cost?
Right. I think it's going to be an enormous challenge. I mean, if you look at the period after World War II, then as Robin said, we had advancing technology and the benefits of that were widely distributed. You know, nearly everyone was made better off. Wages across the board increased, but that's not happening anymore. What's happening is that the fruits of progress are really kind of being captured by a very small number of people at the top, and of course, those are the people that largely own technological capital. And as you look at these trends, there's every reason to believe that this is going to continue. So we're going to see something that's going to continue to drive inequality. And I think at some point it will put at risk the basic economic security of a lot of people at the middle and at the bottom. And that's a hard problem to solve because we may not be able to solve it through traditional means of thinking about how to create jobs or get people into jobs. We may need to actually begin to think outside the box about that. And of course, that's...
You know, that's the bottom line.
It's a staggering political challenge.
Do you think needed drive inequality?
Yes, because one of the things we started this conversation with is the power of deep learning from lots of transactions. So once you are on the automation curve, you've produced this thing, you're seeing all the transactions and you're learning incredibly quickly internally, and that entity, that platform, that automated thing is impossible to catch because you see all the transactions, you get faster, faster, smarter, smarter, smarter with this deep learning. And the other guy, so these things definitely tend towards monopoly, because once you start it and you're on the front edge, you're capturing all that knowledge at a different pace than anyone else.
So can one of you or both of you give us, like, as I understand Facebook Live and other things, people are going to be kind of jumping in and out of this conversation, so let me just reiterate for people where we are on this. We're just having a discussion with two of our country's leading experts on technology and automation and public policy as a result therefrom, about what automation in this moment of particularly quick pace and deep automation, what kind of challenges it presents to the country. So tell me for a second about deep learning. It's kind of used as a term of art. And so what is that basically, so we can have a shared understanding?
Right. Deep learning is a fairly specific technology. It's a form of machine learning, and it's based on what are called neural networks, which is essentially a simulation or a way of designing a computer system so it works more or less like a brain. And this is an idea that's been around for a long time, for decades, but in the last decade or so, there have been some tremendous breakthroughs. Basically, computer scientists have figured out how to build much more complex neural networks with lots of levels of neurons, and they've been able to do some remarkable things. To give some examples, Microsoft's Skype division has demonstrated a deep learning system that can, in real time, translate Mandarin Chinese to English, which is something straight out of Star Trek. I mean, obviously, that's at a fairly primitive level right now, but the fact that it works at all is just really incredible.
That's interesting.
Deep learning is
even without the context and without interaction with an individual, you think translation technology is going to get as good as human technology?
I think it's possible, but it's one thing for sure is that it's going to get good enough to do routine things. That doesn't mean that there won't be opportunities for really expert people to do translation when it really has to be precise. But the technology, I think, in the relatively near future is going to get to the point where it can do, you know, most of the average work. And it's the fact that you can already get a rough translation of something for free now on Google. And that, I mean, if you go back 20 years, that even that is incredible. I mean, you would have had to hire someone
as someone whose kids go to school in foreign language, I have to say I really appreciate that. Foreign language I don't speak, by the way. But that's not to undercut the importance of the point. You suggested yourself, though, that deep learning gives us opportunities in health diagnosis. Deep learning gives us opportunities to identify deviations and patterns on big computer systems so that if there is a cyber attack, if there is an effort to steal personal identifiable information for identity theft, we should be able to get more effective. So it's also a technology that's going to serve great purpose.
That's true.
And already is serving great purpose.
It will. It has tremendous potential. In areas like security, I think it will be essential. I mean, there's an arms race happening there, obviously. The criminals or the people on the other side are using advanced technology to attack our systems. I think that many people would agree that the only way we're going to have security is if we can leverage artificial intelligence on our side to protect against that. So I mean, in many, many areas, it's going to be essential, not just optimistic, but it's also going to bring with it disruption. So there are many, many things that we need to think about there.
So we flip a little bit. So we have all the automated things done, routine things. I feel like a lot of that disruption that we're talking about is actually happening in a certain extent right now, today. So 40% of the people are doing jobs that are very routine, and 60% of jobs that are uncreative entirely and that are easily automated. I feel like we have today an incredible lack of tapping people's unique wisdom and specialties and creativity. So if we think about just pulling these two strands together, if we think about what do we do with those productivity gains, are we going to be slaves to the robots, to automation, or are we going to take those that productivity gains and that fruit to enable us to be our best selves? So I look at this redistribution and I think we need to start thinking about universal basic income, meaning you would have a small amount of money that you would have every month so that you would be protected against this incredibly dynamic work that's happening, that you're losing your job, you're getting your job, you got a crummier job. People are already today incredibly insecure. But to the upside, if I think if people had that platform, that basic minimum, we could be tapping this huge, much, much larger number of people to do things that can't be automated, to be doing their creative tasks that are relational, social, deep in their communities, solving very local and big problems and little problems, that right now we have got such a large percentage of our population doing things just to keep the lights on and to eat. And so I feel like this automation gives us this potential to completely open up and tap this large segment of the population that is not doing interesting or creative work and doesn't care about their jobs. So it does give us this incredible opportunity if we can tap into those productivity gains.
It's interesting. You've written a little bit about this, too.
That's right. I'm a supporter of a guaranteed income eventually. I think that we can all agree that politically it's pretty much off the table in the U.S. right now. But I think it's an idea that we need to at least begin thinking about. And what I've been traveling a lot around the world, and there are some countries that are much further along in thinking about it.
Yeah.
In Switzerland, they just had a referendum on it, and it lost badly, but you know, over 20% of the people in Switzerland voted for it, which is in a sense pretty remarkable.
And 70% said they thought it would come up again, and within 20 years it would exist.
Right. So I think that my view is that it's probably inevitable that we're going to have to think in that way eventually, and that is not just a political challenge, but it's really a challenge to our way of thinking and to our values, our emphasis on the work ethic and all of that. A lot of that may need to be adapted in the future, and that's a big challenge for us. So I think it's great that we're beginning to have this conversation because it's a long process.
Right, so I agree with you entirely that we need to have these pilots. We need to figure out how much do we ask people to do something in return? How precise does it fit in? But I've been thinking, wait. I just lost it, so keep
Let me try one. Let me try one on you. The Finns are trying this. I learned this at the Nordic State Dinner last month from the one of the Finnish ministers. They're trying, and the Finnish ambassador, they're trying guaranteed basic income regionally.
They are.
And so there'll be a bunch of data from that, and we'll see. I'll tell you where we are on this, which is, and we have on Thursday up in New York the third of our workshops on artificial intelligence led by Ed Felton, who's one of our real leaders. And he's a mathematician. He's also from Wisconsin, which makes him level-headed and decent. But we've had these now across the country. Our third will be on Thursday up in New York, New York City, on social and economic implications of artificial intelligence. And I think, and our chief economist, Jason Furman, will give a speech there, really based on the report that we put out, the economic report of the president this year. Chapter 5 of that report, which is available online, does a lot of good work on laying the basis of our understanding of what's happening as a result of automation. We believe, I think, but Jason will spell this out more, and Ed will talk about this on Thursday as well, is I think rather than take the existing safety net and try to reinvent it in a way that the guaranteed basic income would, we ought to do a lot better at what we're doing at the moment. So things like SNAP, which is food assistance, things like tech training, things like just improving schools and opportunities as a general matter, seem to offer a better ability to get up the impact curve more quickly. But the question is it up to the challenge?
Now we get to the discussion part.
Let's go. Let's bring it on. I'll tell you, this is the interesting thing. Sometimes you look at Washington and the debate seems so stale, and this is why I think these things are great. The best, the most robust arguments we have are the ones behind closed doors, and sometimes I wish we had these things in there so people could see it. Because there's not one ideological kind of view on these things. But bring it on. Let's see what we can do.
So if we think about how we're working today and how we'll be working in the future, today, I think it's 34% of Americans are already doing multiple jobs at the same time, are already freelancing, so 54 million people. If we try to cram the social safety nets into a full-time model, that full-time model doesn't exist anymore already. And if I think about this new world we're going to, that I was writing about in my book, that everything that can become a platform is going to become a platform. Companies will be outsourcing. So I had this nice sentence that I got from someone. My father had one job at the same time. I'll have six jobs. My father had one job in his lifetime. I'll have six jobs in my lifetime, and my children have six jobs at the same time. Yeah. And if we think of the bureaucracy of, I think this is where the challenge is lying right now for people, is did I get Social Security on six of my jobs or only on two of my jobs? Am I getting work, insurance on all of them or on none of them? Am I having catastrophic insurance for none because I'm doing six jobs? That we haven't adapted our current regulatory and safety net environment to the reality that people are doing six jobs at the same time, and that we're not going to be going back to one source of income. And one last piece, coming forward to this future, we need to build more resilience into individuals' incomes. And so we need to enable them to diversify their income and to do the six jobs at the same time. So I think that's where I would focus.
I think that's right. But I think I'd ask you to consider, we have this remarkable chart of probabilities. This is a Council of Economic Advisors chart. Probability of being impacted by having your job be impacted by artificial intelligence or automation. And there's 83% probability that if you make less than $20 an hour, now this is all debatable, if you make less than $20 an hour, there's an 83% probability that you're going to be at some risk because of automation and artificial intelligence. So the question is, can we work from there forward by sharpening the safety net? With some of the innovations that you're talking about, being able to make more benefits portable, making sure that our tax code values work the same way it values capital investment returns, and build from there up rather than say, we got to scrap the whole thing. I just got to tell you, I worry that trying to attack it from the top down that way leads to a little too much kind of snaggling on the particulars, whereas we can build on things that work, and we've seen that they work. And I mean, you've made them work. And another question to think about is, rather than if we're going to all these companies being platforms, we also have to make sure that our workers have the skills that can be put to work in those platforms. And I see it every day. My kids are going to school basically the way I went to school. Now, they don't have computer science once a week like I did, but they have computer science rather than computer science being integrated into everything they do. And so I think there's got to be some combination of preparation as well as reaction.
Yeah, I think we probably need two strategies. We need one strategy to continue from where we are in terms of what we do in the short and the intermediate term, but we also need to be thinking about these longer term issues, and that's where I think a guaranteed income comes in. But certainly there are things we can do to improve education, to make community colleges more available. to enhance the safety net, because we know that, you know, even the people that don't buy into the idea that a lot of jobs are going to disappear, nearly everyone would agree that things are going to move much more rapidly and that a lot of opportunities are going to evaporate. People will need time to adapt. We need to have a better safety net in the United States to take care of people during that interim period, because we really don't have that now.
And thinking about your children and this part of, so we've been talking about financial things to support people, but clearly there's cultural things. And part of that culture is this idea of being lifelong learners. And to have that firmly embedded in us, the idea that, yeah, I'm going to school full-time, kindergarten through 12th grade, but my entire life I will expect to and anticipate that I'm always constantly learning things, because the pace of change is so fast.
Yeah.
So we need to make people know how to learn and expect to learn and constantly be on the learning edge. And likely also when you do have a job, that within that job you're also constantly learning, because the pace. So I would put that into the mix of things we need to enable, is a psychological new, a new education standard.
Yeah. Well, I think if you have six jobs at a time, you're going to have to be constantly learning, right?
We're going to be really good at what we do.
Yeah, and all the ways that we do it.
And thinking about protecting against future automation, we particularly want to unlock people's unique skills and passions, because those are the ones that are going to be least likely to be automated. That what I do that is, and solutions I find to problems that I see, I think, is where humans are going to be trumping automation.
Yeah.
That today, maybe even the things we are automating today are the things that rich white men thought were great things, and that there's a huge amount of really important problems that haven't been unlocked because people have been doing their crummy jobs. So if we can open up that opportunity and give them space to take risks, do six jobs at the same time, figure out what you're really good at, and go. There's so many examples. So,
but that's probably an argument for guaranteed income, because a lot of those opportunities are not income generating. You know, they're not necessarily things that someone will pay you to do. So one of the best arguments for guaranteed income is that it would open up these possibilities for people to do things that count, that right now our society does not reward.
Absolutely. I'm completely with you.
Yeah.
I've been quizzing people high and low recently about their passions. No, passion jobs.
You get the first question.
And you guys are doing your passion jobs. And so a fraction of us are getting to do our passion jobs. But I've been talking to, you know, taxi drivers, and one guy was a musician who made music that made autistic children happy, but he could only do it in this tiny fraction of his life. Or I was talking to an engineer, open source engineer that's sleeping on people's couches because he's building his 3D printer fancy software I can't even describe. But all of those are valuable things. I was talking to a consultant who was in her, at nights on a weekend, she was doing food waste in elementary schools, and DC just adopted that idea. But all of these things that people do that are really valuable to society, that we really gain from today, I can't even get to do that because I have to make sure that I am paying my rent and feeding my children.
Yeah. Or now that you've got access to the Affordable Care Act, you're not locked into
that is a,
definite a job.
Step in
you're not locked
the
into
recreation.
A job to keep your health care. You can go get your coverage and keep your kids covered because it's a portable benefit. And we have to figure out how to make more of those portable, if not guaranteed. Which, well, I think we ought to let these guys hammer it out. And I know you guys will be part of some of these conversations coming up. Let me. I don't know how we're doing in terms of time, because I think we wanted to be around 25 or 30 minutes, so we're probably getting close. But let me see if we can take one thing off the table on automation. And it's a little bit outside of the lane of what we've been talking about, but you hinted at it a little bit, which is whether we envision in some kind of specific artificial intelligence, the development of a machine that just outruns our capacity to stop it. Is that like a, so the, whatever the Terminator concept.
Right.
Is this something we should really be worried about? Is this something that there are more present and more urgent dangers, more wolves closer to the door than that we ought to be focused on?
My view is that we shouldn't be worried about that in the near or intermediate term. I think that there are much more relevant issues right now, in particular, how all this is going to impact the job market and the economy. what we're talking about for the foreseeable future is not science fiction artificial intelligence. It's specialized technology that does specialized things. However, that's going to impact a lot of jobs because most people do specialized things. I mean, that was sort of Adam Smith's whole point, that we have this specialization of labor. That's what I worry about the most. But in the longer term, maybe 30, 50, 100 years from now, do we have to worry about that? We can't dismiss it as being silly just because we've seen it in science fiction films. Ultimately, it could be a real concern. And there are certainly very smart people, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, who have, you know, expressed concern about
that. They've rung a lot of bells on this.
So it may eventually be something that we have to worry about.
Do you agree with that?
You phrased it the way I was correctly. Is that our highest thing to be concerned about? And I would say in this time frame, no. Climate change, obviously. No one's going to be around in 30 to 50 or 100 years. So I don't care at all what's going to happen in 100 years if we don't address climate. So for me,
fair enough.
That's the top one.
Fair enough. So this is another thing about policymaking inside the government, which is this is something, you know, we've heard from some of the people you just talked about who are alarmed about this. And we are looking through the Department of Defense at how we can use artificial intelligence, machine learning to increase our defenses, but also are very clear-eyed about making sure that there's appropriate human interaction and any kind of weaponization of any of this artificial intelligence. This, I think, we can be a world leader, and we're designing our policy to be a world leader on establishing a code of conduct and a set of understandings, including perhaps through kinds of arms control arrangements or negotiations that take some of this stuff off the table. And the more we're also seeing these societal and economic questions the same way, I think we can kind of return, we can return to these questions in a way that, you know, America can kind of set the space and set the parameters for how we go about it. Maybe drawing on some of this data that the Finns gin up from the regional basic income.
I feel like if we think of these problems and around security, it feels to me that income inequality will generate a larger security threat than
interesting
than those other things. That it's already, I think, a huge issue, and if automation makes it worse, it'll be even more acute, I think. So we saw Brexit, and we see what's happening politically here, and I think it stems in large part from income inequality and unequal access to opportunity.
Yeah.
And so for me, we need to take this automation boom to address that inequality and access to opportunity and great life of feeling you're worth something and skilled at something.
That's as good a finding to end on as any, but Martin, do you want to have a parting shot here
I would agree. I think the inequality is certainly going to be a huge social issue. It's important to note it's also an economic issue. You know, if we're going to have a successful market economy, if capitalism is going to thrive, we need consumers. We need people who can buy the products and services being produced. And if we eventually have lots of unemployment or wages are driven down, then we don't have enough of those people. So we're not going to have a thriving, growing economy either. So it's really, I think, almost an existential issue that we're really going to have to think seriously about as all of this progresses.
So let me actually, that raises one last question. Automation, artificial intelligence, do we have too much or not enough?
That for me is the distribution parts, because certainly...
You've got to have access to it.
Yeah, I have personally been in 4 car accidents where people died. Would I have preferred to be in a car where people didn't die? Absolutely. And so I look at it and I think drivers and jobs versus 4.4 million serious injuries and 30,000 deaths. How do you choose there? And I think, yeah, you want to choose for life and lack of injury. So,
let's
have more automation.
How about C, all of the above?
No. All of the above, I think we had this, I really do think we had this opportunity to solve, to address so many issues that exist today on the back of that, and to make people have more fulfilled and better lives.
I don't think you can ever have too much technology. I mean, technology is the thing that has driven us toward progress historically. If you look at just an average typical person today, they're much better off in most ways probably than a very wealthy person 100 years ago, and the reason is technology. We don't want to stop that.
We live like
the last thing we want to do is put a halt to that, but we have to understand that we may be entering a disruptive era, kind of a tipping point or an inflection point where things are going to operate differently. We've got to adapt to that so that we can make sure that all of that progress produces shared prosperity, you know, so that it benefits everyone and not just a small number of people. And that's something that we can do if we have the will to do it.
And tying back again to climate, I see automation and this deep collaboration between machines learning and figuring out stuff is the key to our smart cities, smart homes, smart transportation, smart grid, that it's going to require a lot of automation that's doing the unlocking of whatever my crazy behavior is and making me do it more efficiently.
Fair.
So I think it's a key piece of the solution.
Well, so we have a lot of these pieces in tow. We'll hear more about it on Thursday up in New York as it relates to artificial intelligence and automation. But from Tech Hire to computer science for all to address some of these diversity questions around technology. We've tried to focus on this, but I want to thank you both for coming, Martin and Robin. This is not by any means the end of the conversation here on this, as I know you guys will make plainly clear we'll continue later this week on Thursday, but it also I hope does not mean the end of this forum, which gives us an opportunity to do exactly what the president has been talking about as he's been addressing the country, going back to the State of the Union, where he's calling on citizens to take control of their futures, to make sure that they're engaged in the national debate, to put real solutions on the table, but also identify real challenges that we face, and this is obviously one of them. So I appreciate you guys coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate the work you do. And while we get this all straightened out by, say, early January, then we'll be all set. Okay? Then we'll move on to the next thing.
Exactly.
Okay? All right. Thanks, everybody.